would like to say a special thank you to Pfizer Healthcare Ireland for sponsoring this episode of the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you.
Today on the podcast, we are delighted to be joined by Michael Ross, a nurse practitioner on the breast medicine service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York. When we mentioned we wanted to record an episode on metastatic breast cancer, Michael's name came up straight away. Today, Michael helps listeners to understand their genetics and their cancer's genetics and characteristics a bit better. We also touch on some of the advances and treatment options available for patients in the metastatic phase of breast cancer and what treatment options may be coming down the line. Thank you so much, Michael, for your time.
So, Michael, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. I think you're our first international guest all the way over in America. So thank you so much for working with our time differences and everything. You're great. We feel really grateful to have you on the podcast today. And I suppose really the aim of the podcast today is to try and help people understand their breast cancer a little bit better. And we also want to focus on some of the advances and treatments available for patients with the metastatic in the metastatic breast cancer phase, if that's okay.
That sounds fantastic. And I am absolutely honored to be your inaugural international podcast person. So, but I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation and try to provide a little bit of insight to patients in regards not only to the disease and how we manage metastatic breast cancer, but also some hopefully tips and ideas on how to help them navigate their journey as they move forward.
Brilliant. Well, I suppose, as I said in the intro, we're going to really be discussing about metastatic breast cancer. So I suppose I might just ask you just to explain what is metastatic breast cancer?
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's always great to start with that definition. Metastatic breast cancer, as I describe it to patients, is cancer that has moved beyond the local region of the breast, whatever side that breast cancer, that primary breast cancer may have presented. So for example, if it was in the left breast, we would consider a recurrence that happened anywhere on the opposite side of the chest. So crossing that sternal border, that breastbone border, or to a distant organ, the liver, the bones, perhaps the brain, the lung, anywhere that is not within that kind of left chest wall, axillary, you know, side, then that would be considered metastatic.
And I know everybody's like cancer can behave quite differently, and it's difficult to kind of, I suppose, specifically answer this question, but I suppose most commonly, what are the most likely places for breast cancer cells to spread to?
Yeah, and that's a fantastic question. And, you know, the longer I do this, the one phrase I have that is been proven to be true is never say never. Mm-hmm. So you can never definitively say exactly how something's going to behave. But there are some organs where breast cancer, and in particular certain subtypes of breast cancer, if they're going to spread to a distant organ and metastasize as stage 4 disease, also known as metastatic, then we kind of know where to look. So for example, I always go head to toe with my patients in terms of asking for those symptoms that would clue me in that there might be a distant disease. So The CNS, so any symptoms within the brain, headaches, balance, those types of things. And HER2 positive disease tends to be preferentially metastasizing to the central nervous system. Again, any other type can. The bones are also a very likely place for metastases. Hormone-sensitive breast cancers tend to like to go to the bone. Again, they can go anywhere. Other target organs, lung, liver, lymph nodes, peritoneum. When you think about lobular breast cancer, which is about 15% of breast cancers, when that metastasizes, it tends to like linings of tissues and organs, and in particular, the abdomen. So we often will see a lobular metastatic breast cancer present as a thickening in the colon or a nodule within the abdominal, or, you know, the peritoneal wall. So, you know, those are you know, some of the most likely places. But of course, we're going to investigate anything that seems particularly odd. But mm-hmm. I guess to kind of summarize, brain, bones, lung, liver, lymph nodes, maybe the peritoneum.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for that explanation. I think it's a really clear explanation, and also it helps people understand that, you know, it can really be anywhere as well at the same time, even though there is kind of more likely places that it can go to. You touched off a couple of different types of breast cancer there, but we know that before we start any treatment or planning any kind of treatment plan for a patient, we need to understand the actual tumor a little bit better and its characteristics. So can you help our listeners understand how tumors are characterized and the different types of, drivers for breast cancer?
Absolutely. And it is absolutely critical. Standard of care is if there is a tissue, something you see on imaging, a lesion, anything that looks suspicious for stage 4 disease, that you absolutely need to get a biopsy, tissue of that suspected area, prior to really developing your treatment plan. One would want to think that that basic concept is widespread enough that you would never see practice that does not do it. However, from time to time, I still will. A patient will come in with a history of an early stage breast cancer, have imaging that looks suspicious for metastases, and will have been started on treatment without actually getting tissue and verifying exactly what they're targeting and how they want to approach it. Why do we have to do this? Because breast cancer, and let's start again from a primary breast cancer tumor, is there's heterogeneity, meaning it's not the same. How I try to get patients to understand this is, let's say you gave your three-year-old a blue Play-Doh, yellow Play-Doh, and red Play-Doh, and they mixed it up, and you stuck a needle into it, and you want to believe that that is representative. However, you may not have gotten all the different colors of the Play-Doh within your biopsy specimen. The same is true with breast cancer. And so we treat that early stage breast cancer, but there may have been a very small minority population clone, like a tiny bit of the red Play-Doh that you never picked up. And you effectively treated all the other, but that red is what was allowed to stick around and then at some point metastasized. So you don't know from that original tumor what had the capability to go somewhere else and now create a problem today. Mm-hmm. So you need to biopsy that, and you will see where the primary tumor was hormone sensitive, and now this metastatic site, let's say in the lung, is triple negative, absolutely mm-hmm. does not respond to hormone therapies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why we want to do that is to know, is it the same? Is the mm-hmm. biology the same? And how we determine that is getting new tissue, testing that tissue, and looking for the following markers: ER for estrogen receptor, PR for progesterone, HER2, whether or not it will respond to HER2-directed therapies. PD-L1 is now a new one, which tells us whether or not you would utilize immune therapies. So, you know, you've got to know not what was 3 years ago, but exactly what the biology is of those cancer cells as they are today. Mm-hmm. Now, that's characterizing the cancer's genetic makeup or the biologic makeup. Genetically, you would also characterize the tumor by doing genetic testing. There are molecular targets, such as a mutation in the PIK3CA gene, for which there are drugs. We have those drugs here in America. PIKRAY is one of them. I don't believe it's approved in the EMEA just yet, but there you not only characterize the biomarkers, which is ER, PR, HER2, and PD-L1, you also characterize the genetics of that cancer. You may want to see if there's what's called an ESR1, so it's an estrogen receptor 1 mutation. If that's the case, then we know that aromatase inhibitors do not work well in that cancer, okay? So you really have to characterize it biologically, genetically. And then you also need to make sure that the patient has a genetic profile. What are their genes like? And the reason that's important is that, especially in a triple negative cancer, but it can be in a hormone receptor positive breast cancer, if the patient carries a BRCA, BRCA1 or 2 germline mutation, there are the PARP inhibitors, olaparib and talazoparib, which can be utilized to treat their cancer. So we got to know the makeup every which way of both the tumor and also the patient in order to then set a plan that targets and selects that therapy that best fits that profile of the receptors, the profile of the genetics of both the tumor and the host.
I suppose if we had somebody, or if you were seeing somebody in clinic and you were trying to explain to them, you have hormone positive or you have HER2 or HER2 low, how would you normally explain that to them? Just for somebody who's listening who might think, oh yeah, I've heard that word HER2 or HER2 low, but I don't really understand it. Would you mind just talking us through just what each of them mean, if you don't mind?
In terms of HER2 and HER2 low?
Yes.
Yeah. I try to talk about these receptors, which it's very easy to kind of get lost in the alphabet soup of cancer.
Yeah.
ERPR, PIK3, ATM, all of those types of things. But simply, all of these are shorthands for proteins. Proteins that are expressed within that breast cancer cell, and proteins which tell us what types of food, if you will, fuel, causes that cell to grow and divide more quickly. So in the case of ER and PR, we know that estrogens are the fuel that when the cancer is exposed to it, that cancer will grow and divide more quickly. In the case of HER2, that's had a bit of an evolution in terms of what it means to be HER2 positive, and now a new category of HER2 low or HER2 negative. HER2 is also a protein. It is a protein that when the ligand, that protein that comes and hooks onto it, onto the HER2 protein receptor, starts the signal that says grow and divide. Now, our oldest, but still exquisitely effective HER2 directed therapies, Herceptin being the classic, trastuzumab, blocks that receptor and causes that cell not to grow and divide at that more accelerated rate that happens when those proteins are connected and the signal is grow and divide, grow and divide. In the original trastuzumab clinical trials, the cutoff for whether or not we thought there was an overexpression, meaning lots and lots of HER2 protein receptors on the surface of the cell, was looking at a staining and calling it 3+ by staining or a ratio 2 or greater in terms of looking at the gene ratio to the number of cells. So pretty much since almost 20 years, to receive HER2 directed therapy, you either had to have a robust staining of the HER2 proteins, meaning 3+ or more as a pathologist would look at it, or a genetic ratio by FISH testing, fluorescent in situ hybridization, if you're into what that acronym stands for, of the ratio of what the chromosomes, the genes that code for HER2 versus the number of cells of 2 or higher. We now know, we now have a medication called trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is an antibody drug conjugate. So there's an antibody that then brings a payload of chemotherapy to the site of disease, where you don't have to have nearly as much expression, nearly as many HER2 proteins in that cancer cell in order for the drug to still get to where it needs to go. And so now there's a category of HER2 low, meaning that if the staining is 1+, which traditionally was negative, or the staining were HER2+, but a negative FISH, which was also considered negative, those patients can now receive trastuzumab deruxtecan. And there's overall survival data that even with some expression, but not robust expression of the HER2 protein, that this therapy is effective and improves overall survival.
And I think that's really transformative for a lot of people who might not have had as many options before if they technically weren't HER2 positive or what we previously categorized HER2 positive. So I think I might have been saying there was a lot of excitement at ASCO and stuff last year when they were presenting the studies on all of this and they were talking about how effective it can be in this category of patients. So I suppose it's just reassuring to see all the time how different drugs are evolving and different patient groups are being formed. I suppose you've talked about some of the subtypes of cancer there. taking these subtypes, if we could do them one by one, could you just tell us about some of the advances in these areas in recent years? Like you mentioned TDXD, I wonder, could we take them individually and go through them so that each person listening, if they identify with a certain type of breast cancer, will kind of know what's being done in their area?
Absolutely. And just to kind of put a number to this new category, the size of the population of the HER2 low group, it's around 40% of breast cancers.
Wow. So
it's not a small one. It's a pretty impressive one.
Yeah.
But in terms of advances by tumor type, starting with the most common type of metastatic disease, hormone sensitive breast cancers, we've certainly over the last 5, 6, 7 years had, with the advent of CDK4/6 inhibitors, have seen a huge improvement in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival. So that's absolutely standard of care. In the hormone receptor positive space as well, once another oral therapy that we do have in the U.S. that, like I said, is not available in Europe, I believe at this point, is PIK3CA mutated cancer. About around 30%, I believe, of hormone-sensitive breast cancers actually have a mutation in the PIK3CA gene, and you can couple that with hormone therapy in order to increase progression-free survival. That refractory, that endocrine refractory hormone-sensitive breast cancer, previously sensitive, but ERPR expressing breast cancer, in terms of an infusional therapy, there is another antibody drug conjugate called sacituzumab govitecan. Sacituzumab is actually an antibody. It's a protein. And what it likes to do is go and hook onto another protein called TROP2. And it initially received its approval in triple negative, but now has data that shows even in hormone-sensitive breast cancers that the patient may have progressed through a couple of lines of hormone therapy and now needs an infusional therapy, that it in the second or third line of infusional therapy actually does have benefit. So, you know, this was not something that even a year ago we would have been able to offer our patients, but now we do have patients that have moved through the first lines of hormone therapy for metastatic breast cancer, may have had oral capecitabine, may have had a first line Taxol, and now, you know, this is the third line, quote unquote, chemotherapy that they would not even have had had as an option before then. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the hormone sensitive space. In terms of triple negative space, the most recent developments over the last couple of years being first line therapy here in the US, standard of care, if that patient expresses PD-L1, which is the protein that tells us whether or not they'll respond to immune therapy, we would start with immune therapy.
Oh, and that's first line, is it?
First line recommended metastatic triple negative. Yep.
Okay.
If they are PD-L1 positive, and that is the combination of pembrolizumab with a chemotherapy background. And in that trial, I think it was Keynote 322, there were three different chemotherapy backbones, Abraxane or protein-bound Taxol, and I think the last one was Gemcarbo. So that's a new development over the last couple of years. And then the drug I just mentioned that started in triple negative, sacituzumab govitecan. Govitecan, you'll notice it sounds a lot like irinotecan, which is an older drug, works against breast cancer, but it's kind of tough to do because it's got a reasonably significant side effect profile. But now by putting a drug that's similar to it onto an antibody that will take it like a Trojan horse exactly where you need it to go by hooking onto that trope protein on the cancer cell, is very effective and much less toxic than it was. So, you know, triple negative things that 5 years ago we would not have talked about in the triple negative space, we would not have talked about immune therapy, we would not have talked about sacituzumab govitecan, an antibody drug conjugate, we would not have talked about PARP inhibitors, olaparib, talazoparib, which we have, and we would not have talked about hey, are you truly triple negative, or now are you now in this new subgroup of HER2 low?
Yeah, it's so encouraging to hear like the advancement from triple negative, so, you know, because they've always I suppose it's always just been a little bit slower in the advancements and with triple negative. So it's really encouraging to hear.
Yeah. And then even in the HER2 positive space, I mean, when I started doing this 12 years ago, we had Herceptin, we had, you know, pertuzumab that was only in the metastatic space, which now is early stage neoadjuvant, adjuvant. You know, we've added on many other drugs, some of the most recent ones being tucatinib, which is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, when paired with capecitabine and Herceptin, has shown great benefit in overall survival, especially in CNS disease for the HER2-positive population. And then, you know, the first indication for trastuzumab deruxtecan was not HER2-low, it was in HER2-positive as defined traditionally, and has been very impressive and redefining how we sequence our HER2-directed therapies in the metastatic setting.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for making that so clear, because I know this is a very complex complex topic, and you said it yourself with, like, you know, the alphabet and stuff. There's a lot of words thrown out
there.
I think if people are even able to pick up on a couple of questions that they can bring and they can ask their doctors and just have a better understanding of what treatment is out there, and also just what's being done for them and what's coming down the line, just think it's really important, especially for this group of patients with metastatic cancer, to know that there's a lot of work being done in the background for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose, sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, and I would tag onto that theme that the developments are many and the developments come quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, I've been on this particular service for 12 years, and sometimes I catch myself thinking, I've got to get to retirement because I just can't keep up anymore. You know, because it is, which is a wonderful luxury to be in that spot. That we really do have such an arsenal that's expanding. And what's great about the arsenal is not only is it expanding in terms of effectiveness and much more targeted and selective by the biology of the cancer and the person themselves, the side effect profiles are improving.
That's great, isn't it? And I suppose
more targeted. We're taking the drug and the treatment to where the cancer is, not just spreading it across the entire body.
Yeah, and I suppose to reassure patients, in Ireland we generally do follow suit from America. It's just a little bit slower before it gets here. So, something that you did touch on previously was genetics and the importance of genetics. But what's confusing, I think, for a lot of people is that the differentiation between the personal genetics and then the actual genetics of a particular cancer. So, would you mind just touching on what's the difference between the two?
Absolutely. So when someone talks about the role of genetics in the treatment of a breast cancer, there is the tumor, and that's what we call somatic mutation. So what errors or what DNA errors do we see that we find when we look at the tissue that's from the cancer itself? And that's a somatic mutation. So a somatic mutation, for example, might be PIK3CA, it may be ATM, it might be mTOR. Once again, that whole alphabet soup that we kind of talk to. But that tells us where the cancer may have an error and a targetable weakness. Then there are the genetic mutations of the human being that I've had in my cells from the very moment of conception, and that's called a germline mutation. And so we're probably most familiar with BRCA1 and BRCA2, but there are, of course, CHEK, PALB2, you know, an evolving host of what they are. There are right now only BRCA1 and BRCA2 have medications that if the germline, meaning the genes of the person, have that mutation, offer a therapy. And those are the PARP inhibitors, talazoparib and olaparib. And even in the US, there's an indication to do a year of that therapy in early stage treatment, which actually does have a significantly statistically significant reduction in recurrence just by utilizing that therapy as an extra layer of insurance for an early stage breast cancer. So somatic is the tumor, germline is the human being. And what you one also has to understand, if you look at a somatic, so the genes of the cancer genetic report, it will carry in it the initial mutations from the host, because they indeed came from the host, okay? So a BRCA mutation within a cancer cell and a BRCA mutated person is really not all that impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that that description. I think it really does help differentiate it, because I know a lot of our patients can get really confused when they hear the genetics of your cancer and your genetics, and it is quite overwhelming for everyone to take in. So thanks a million for explaining that. We know that obviously patients with an advanced cancer, such as metastatic breast cancer, can often have several lines of treatment, and they can be on treatment for a very long time. So I suppose, in your opinion and your experience, how do you know when it's the right time to switch treatments, if that's the right thing to do?
Yep. And, you know, from the 10,000 foot perspective, you know, someone comes in and it may be their very first treatment for metastatic diagnosis for stage 4 disease, and they are like, their question is, so how long am I on this? And I explained to him that therapy is lifelong, that we now can approach it as a chronic disease that we can treat and manage. We cannot cure it, but we can control it, the same as one might think about diabetes. But how long are you on a particular therapy? And I will say to them one of two things. Number one, that the disease figures out how to get around it. And we see that in terms of progression on scans. Mm-hmm. Or number two, there's an unacceptable toxicity. There's a side effect that is not allowing us to give you disease control with an acceptable quality of life. So those are the two things. And, you know, even with the first one, progression, how do we actually say this person has progressed? I will talk to people that there are really three ways we look at how they're doing. Number one, how are you doing clinically? How do you feel? So if you had a stage 4 disease to the bones, and we give you a therapy, and the pain in the back has now gone away, you are clinically better. Mm-hmm. And that's, to some extent, what we really want, you know, because how you feel is, you know, key to giving you quality, not just life, but quality life. So how are you clinically doing? Number two, how are you biochemically doing? What are we seeing in terms of the labs? If you have, you know, liver lesions and the liver function tests have come down, that is a biochemical response. If we're following tumor markers and they go down, that is a biochemical response. And then number three is imaging, CT, PET scan, those types of things. So it's really kind of looking at all three of those responses, clinical, biochemical, and radiographic, that we say, yes, you're stable. Yes, there was a response, or no, there's been progression. There are times where radiographically there's subtle changes, and there may be a number of subtle changes, increases in the disease burden, but the patient continues to feel well, their labs continue to look good. So you're like, I think we can ride this out. So, you know, that becomes part of the art of managing someone with stage 4 disease, is really, once again, you know, triangulating those three things. Also thinking about, which line of therapy is this? Do I have another really good choice for them? Which all goes into the determination of, let's stay with the current therapy, or this is truly a progression that I think we need to address, and you can do better in terms of those criteria on something else.
Brilliant. And I think thank you so much for setting that expectation as well, Michael, that in the metastatic setting, treatment is lifelong. I think sometimes that can get lost and people do expect that there can be an end to, you know, treatment. But if it's not that treatment, there will be another one. So I just think it's important to set that expectation. So thanks for highlighting that. And also just as well, the importance of how people feel. There's so much value as to how a person is actually feeling. As you said, it's multi-tiered, looking at the bloods and the imaging, but a huge part of it is how somebody is actually feeling. So thanks for acknowledging both of them. I suppose we know patients with metastatic cancer a lot of times can have been on a lot of intravenous treatments, and sometimes I suppose they might feel like they need a break. Is there an opportunity for them in some cases to change to an oral medication as a bit of a treatment, or as a bit of a treatment break? Or have you any kind of ideas on that?
You know, absolutely. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I think we need to approach being a provider with a great deal of humility. Yeah. And I heard it said really well once, we have recommendations, patients have choices.
Yeah.
And I think we absolutely have to remember that because at the end of the day, it is their life. One of the great things about the expansion of the arsenal is that we really do have lines of therapy that can flip back and forth between infusional and oral. And a great example of that would be in the HER2 positive space. Someone may have been going along and standard of care first line therapy for HER2 positive disease is a taxane combined with trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And then they carry on. If they get a great response, you know, you can drop the taxane and carry on with the trastuzumab and pertuzumab. That may be, let's say, 4 years. I have people that are still on it at 10 years. But let's say it's 4 years, there's progression, there are new symptoms, the labs, the clinical, and the radiographics say there's progression. Someone may say, I have been coming in here for 4 years, every 3 weeks, I'm tired. I want the summer away from you. And we don't take that personally. And we're like, you know what? That's not unreasonable. So, you know, an option such as a combination of capecitabine and neratinib is a choice. Mm-hmm. So people could do that. There's progression-free survival data on that. So it's like, all right, you could do that for a while. Mm-hmm. So we really can talk about how to mix and match these. And you're never going to make an oncologist, you know, thrilled. But, you know, if someone's had no evidence of disease for a chunk of time, you know, I have seen patients make the choice to halt therapy for a while. We get super, super duper uncomfortable. But again, it's their journey, not our journey.
Yeah.
But I think we do have great choices to keep people on therapy and give them an infusional IV break.
Mm-hmm. Something you actually mentioned earlier, which is so true, is with the advancements in treatment, even for us to keep up, it can be so overwhelming, and the new terminology and new treatments. And so for patients, it can be so overwhelming with changes in treatment and just keeping up with the terminology in general. And it can be a scary place at times, which leads people to resort to Google to try and read up on things themselves, which can be a whole other scary place in itself. So have you experienced this in your practice? I know we see it a lot. And I suppose, do you have any advice around this?
I do have some advice, and I think we all have that experience. And whether we're talking about treating cancer or any other topic that you want to pick in today's modern society, everyone that has an internet connection also happens to have an opinion.
Yeah,
that's fine. The diffusion of information is great. And I do believe that an informed, self-directed patient is the best asset in this journey. But at the same time, I really do encourage patients to utilize the reputable sites, the American Cancer Society, Living Beyond Breast Cancer, as opposed to a chat room that has a link to somewhere that's a bit dubious.
Yeah.
It's a good place to perhaps generate some questions. It's a terrible place to try to get answers. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is always getting these things within context, because we've already discussed about how many variables lead into a particular patient's therapy and what makes it right for them. And there are a few situations that you can extrapolate and copy and paste that therapy to another person. So, you know, feel free to look a bit. I would encourage you not to look a lot.
Yeah.
Try to stay on the reputable sites that are well validated in terms of government sites. You know, like I said, the American Cancer Society is a great site. Advocacy groups and like Living Beyond Breast Cancer, their stuff is well vetted. I would say try to stay out of the blogs, try to stay out of the chat rooms. It's like reviews of a restaurant. You're only going to hear about the people that really hated what they had. It's going to be skewed and it's not going to be very well balanced. It's going to be taken out of context. Mm-hmm. And I would say ultimately, all of this, all you do has to be something that where you feel you have established a relationship of trust with your treatment team, that when you come to them and ask them questions, and that's fantastic, please do. We get excited about trying to tell people what we think we know. You know, but at the same time, it is complex. Mm. We do this every day, all year long, years at a time. Mm. And there ultimately has to be that, you know what, I trust you. Mm. And I'm going to, you know, if I don't understand, I'm going to defer to that experience and that expertise, not blindly, but based on a history of establishing trust. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, if you don't feel good about the connection with your healthcare provider, you need to look for another one. It has to be a partnership that's based in, you know, trust. And that way it becomes therapeutic. And mm-hmm. if you don't trust them at this point, it will be harder to trust them as you go further down the road when the decisions become more difficult.
Absolutely. And you mentioned it earlier on when we were talking about treatment, but I suppose it's the same with, you know, your treatment team. Patients have choices and it's important for them to remember that. And it can be difficult, I think, at times to remember it, especially when you're hit with a cancer diagnosis. But you're so right in everything you've said there, Michael. I suppose a natural question for somebody to ask when they hear that their cancer has returned or it's metastatic is, how much time do I have? How would you answer that question?
You hear it consistently, yeah. And you wish that you had good data in order to give people expectations. But the truth is, and I will say, you know what, we don't know that at this point, especially as we start off. What I can tell you is that the answer I would have given you 5 years ago would be wrong today, because we do have more therapies and our therapies are better tolerated, more effective. And so whatever answer I give you today, by the time you get to that end date that we would say might be likely today, we will be wrong. Okay. So, you know, that truly is between that is truly a function of, you know, what the biology of this cancer is going to declare itself to be, and also whatever your higher power, you know, leads you to your journey. I do tell people, I will go this far and I will say, your first line or two of therapy will give us a good insight into how responsive your disease is. If you start someone on first line hormone receptor, you know, an aromatase inhibitor and, you know, a CDK4/6 inhibitor like palbociclib, and that person gets, you know, has a clinical response, has a radiographic response, and that lasts for 3 or 4 years, and that is a positive prognosticator. If they have progressed within 6 months and their second scan, that's a concerning prognosticator. So the ability of this cancer to progress through lines of therapy quickly, if it does it a number of times, that answer to the question is probably shorter than if someone gets on something and it's years before they go on to the next thing. So, you know, the cancer itself is going to tell us to some extent what that answer is, and we don't know that when we start out. But again, I would absolutely say the other reason we don't know this is that we just don't have that crystal ball that tells us not just what your cancer will do, but also what science and research will do. And I think, and that number of the median survival from a metastatic diagnosis keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think there's every reason to be hopeful that you're going to do really, really well for a really long time. And that's the North Star that I would use to start off this, what I call the marathon journey, mm-hmm. as opposed to the sprint of early stage breast cancer.
Mm. I think it's actually a really nice way of putting it. You know, it's really honest, but also, like you say, we can't control what's going to happen in life, but also these advancements are coming all the time. So it is really hopeful. And yeah, it's hopefully reassuring for a lot of people listening, fingers crossed.
And there are some people that I say, you know, you've done so well for so long, your risk of mortality is, you're more likely to get hit by the M15 bus going down Second Avenue than you are to have something happen as a result of this cancer. So, let's plan for the future. Let's live in the moment. And I say this routinely, if you feel well, then let yourself be well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important because, you know, it can be such a difficult diagnosis to digest, and it can be really challenging psychologically, you know, and understandably so. But yeah, like you say, if you have a good day, like really embrace it and allow yourself to live and do whatever it is you want to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it sounds a bit, you know, a bit brutal to say, but, you know, being human is a terminal diagnosis.
Yeah.
And none of us know if our time is long or short.
Yeah.
What we do know is the day that we have today. Mm-hmm. And so again, our goal as clinicians and to partner with you as a patient to manage this disease, control it in a way that you have many, many days where you feel exquisitely good. Yeah. And we can do that to where you can do the things that matter to you for whatever time any of us have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose anybody that's not having that many good days, and, you know, side effects are challenging, or it's just a difficult time, to just reach out to your team as much as possible. And they can help you with this, because we don't want anybody struggling unnecessarily on treatment, you know.
Yep. I will tell people, if it bothers you, it bothers me. Let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate you covering this topic with us. It's great to have you. And I think you explained a very complex topic really succinctly. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're going to be a highly requested nurse now after we release this podcast.
Absolutely. I would take this, you know, all within context. You know, it's a good place to start. It's not the best place to finish necessarily, but I do think we covered some really important topics. And I think, you know, the critical thing is, know you and your genetics, know the cancer, its genetics and its biology, and then partner with the team that you trust so that you truly build out a long series of time where you feel well. And we don't just extend life, which we absolutely can do, but we extend really good quality of life.
Yeah, so important.
But absolutely delighted. And, you know, to use an old country expression, absolutely, I'm not a New Yorker. I grew up in the Midwest. I'm an old farm boy. But I am absolutely tickled to be here and, you know, absolutely honored by the opportunity to talk about this, and absolutely humbled by the courage of the people that go through their breast cancer journey.
Yeah, I've learned so much from every single one of them that I've looked after, and it's such an honor and a privilege to be able to do the job that we do. So I completely agree with you.
Yep.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at @theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.